Hi, this is Writers After Dark. Good stories start with the writers, and wherever there is a story, someone's either making it up or writing it down. We are here to talk to the storytellers about their stories. And since the Hugo Awards were recently announced, I think it's appropriate that I get to use an interview I did a year ago, hoping to start Writers After Dark last year, but we have good news. The book we're talking about and its author have been nominated for Hugo Awards, Nebula Awards, Philip K. Dick Awards, and just general overall really cool person awards. You're going to be hearing an interview I did, like I said, last year with Mer Lafferty about her novel Six Wakes, which is a space opera murder mystery conspiracy theory mentally twisty adventure. So we will get right into that interview right now. My guest today is social media maven and author Mer Lafferty, whose latest book, Six Wakes, is catching a lot of attention these days. It is a fabulous story. First off, I just want to say that. Thank you for that, Mer.
Oh, yes, you're welcome, Summer. It was all for you.
And I have become very picky about my science fiction lately because There's too much to read and not enough time to read it all. I blame getting old.
Yeah.
So a story that has an interesting premise that jumps into the middle of the action from the jump and keeps you guessing to the point where you think you figured out what's going on, and then you have that little notion disabused is fun. I like trying to follow the breadcrumbs, but I also like not being able to predict exactly where they're going.
Mm-hmm.
First of
well,
all,
cool. I guess that worked.
So yeah, thank you for putting out a really cool story that combines, like I said, mystery, a little bit of thriller, and space opera. I mean, those are three of my big loves, and you mix them very, very well.
Awesome. Thank you.
And I read somewhere that your inspiration for this premise was a video game.
In part, yeah. Yeah. The video game FTL, Faster Than Light, is a sort of space battle game where you manage your spaceship and you upgrade your spaceship and you are trying to race to a certain area before you're caught, and you have crew on the spaceship. So one of the things you can do to upgrade your spaceship is you can either have a med bay, which heals people, or a cloning bay, which brings them back. But they only bring them back once they die. You can't just put one person in the cloning bay and make a whole bunch of them to staff every part of your ship. And I thought, I hadn't really seen cloning used like that. And then, you know, I started the ball rolling of, well, you know, if cloning is widely available, they're not going to want people to make a whole bunch of themselves. There's overpopulation. There's a question of legality, of ownership, of estates. There's, you know, it would get really complicated really fast, and it would start to be regulated. And I've always been interested in the generational starship concept, so those things just kind of started fitting together.
Well, Give us an overview of the story before we dive in as best we can without spoiling it.
Yes. Well, it's been called Lost in Space, only Lost, comma, in space, like the TV show Lost.
Right.
Because there's a setup, but then, and you think you know who the characters are, and then I show flashbacks that tell a little bit more of the story. But the concept is, there's a skeleton crew driving a generation starship, and they're designed to die, you know, when they either get injured or die of old age, they wake up a new clone and keep going. They record their memories. It's all very, very neat and tidy. Unfortunately, at the first scene, they all wake up at once, all of them in a new body, and all of their old bodies are around them, very brutally murdered. And so they realize one of them has to have done it, and they don't know who. And each person doesn't even know if they're the murderer because they're missing several years of memories, and so they have no idea what happened in the past several years. So that's the basic setup. I tried to bring in a very diverse group of characters, both with backgrounds and in ethnicities. And yeah, I just tried to make a good ensemble cast and put them in a really bloody scene to start out with and then see where it went from there.
What's the catchphrases? And then hijinks ensue.
Yes. Exactly. Many hijinks.
Oh, many, many hijinks. And this is the first story in a long time where I don't feel comfortable telling anybody anything about it except the overview, because you risk spoiling a twist. There are so many twists in this story. Even a flashback was a reveal that I had to go back and reread it because I'm like, wait, did I miss something? Hang on here. And that was, to me, that's a lot of fun. Just when you're so into a story and you realize, wait, they dropped this clue. Wait, I have to go back. Oh man, where was that? And just to be as engaged in a book as I usually get with a television show, for me is refreshing and fun.
Oh, that's awesome to hear. That's very high praise. Thank you. I don't know how I did it. I mean, I was questioning myself throughout the entire writing of this book. My editors at Orbit were very good with helping me shore up some of the weak points and pointing out what needed to be edited. And I really enjoyed working with them. And, you know, I wouldn't have been able to do it without them, but I'd never written anything like this before. So I was just unsure of where I was going, but you know, I did a lot of reading Agatha Christie because I'd never written a mystery before. So I read a whole bunch of her books and tried to figure out how she puts her stuff together. Well, put her stuff together, past tense. And I think I learned a lot that way. But it was fun to write. I just was not sure it would be this well received. I'm really, really excited.
And like I said, the characters go beyond just being diverse. They are varying personality quirks. I think it's safe to say you have the OCD type, the couple of A types, a couple of, shall we say, questionable mental stability types. And they are different enough from each other. And from what you would see, I mean, they never once while reading these characters did the word trope come into mind.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Yeah. They were real people. They had flaws and, what's the word I'm looking for? Quirks. And just, they were themselves from the get-go. I never at any time confused one person for another. They were very solidly portrayed. The pictures of them were drawn slowly, especially with the flashbacks. And that type of character building, I know, usually takes a lot of effort. And I think it paid off.
Thank you. I don't even know, you know, people ask the inspirations and, you know, I can't remember coming up with the variety of different characters of who I wanted to be in what role. It just kind of came to me. I'm a hardcore pantser, and I get my best ideas in the midst of writing. So if I can get something sparking one idea and I start writing, all the others will follow. And which is really exciting and it's fun to do, but it makes things like, you know, if a publisher says, send me an outline, it makes that difficult. But luckily this book, people get interested in this book based on the concept, but I'm glad they stay because of the characters.
The concept was not the primary interest for me. The reason behind it was, like, the reason behind regulating the cloning and the especially the beginning part where you wrote up the what happened and how they came up with the legislation, that was intriguing to me, because you have these legal precedents. It's like, okay, we have this new technology, we have to put boundaries on it or else we will have problems. And it's something we run into current day with our computers and our smartphones and our other mobile devices, drones, all sorts of little, who can you aim your camera at and who shouldn't you? And when are those people allowed to aim a shotgun at your $6,000 drone? So that part fascinated me. How much of the legal background did you have to look up for to come up with this precedent setting regulation, shall we say?
I didn't do a lot of legal research at all. I just tried to figure out where the problems would crop up with cloning made readily available to anybody. And, you know, the problems are overpopulation, what happens to estate law, whether your clone or your children legally inherit from you. And then there's the issue of, you know, there's the great idea of, well, if we can record memories and DNA as computer files, well, then the next step is they can be hackable and you could fix all sorts of things like genetic problems. If someone's transgender, you can make them the correct gender the next time around. I mean, you could do all these wonderful things, but then you know that people would start doing other things like parents deciding they want a blue-eyed child instead of a brown-eyed child. And because, you know, so there would be misuse there. And so I tried to think of everything that would go wrong. And then Neil Gaiman has a phrase that I really like, which is, the law is a hammer, not a scalpel. So if you want to cut down on people drowning their own children in the tub so that they can clone them and bring back a more attractive child, you have to cut down on people getting genetic problems taken care of. And so a lot of the laws passed upset a lot of the clones. But a lot of them just seemed, I just tried to go common sense and a little farther, because that's how laws seem to be written in my very limited explanation of how I see the law, which is common sense and then a little bit farther.
Well, in the setting for how the laws came about, you did, I thought, a pretty good job of showcasing the outrage and concern on both sides of the issue, because that's where these laws usually come from. You have a whole lot of people upset about something. Some want to do away with it. Others want to just rein it in a little bit. And you have other people who are like, no, 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 no. And others, yes, yes, yes. And then you start arguing with each other and you come up with laws.
Right. Yeah, but that's pretty much it.
Yeah, and I thought that section of how these restrictions, these regulations came about, showed a very, I guess, insightful side to the world these people were living in, and one reason why they went on this journey on this ship. And having clones to take over for you and bring you back as you with all of your memories, all your skills, all your education intact when you're on a interstellar journey that would take, you know, 100 years. That's a very, very cool way to do it because you don't have to worry about people having kids, raising those kids, making sure all the kids know all the rules and how everything functions. You don't really risk losing vital information that might affect the operation of the ship, you know, 40 years later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the whole we've been in space so long, we don't remember why we're here plot line is very common with the whole generational starship genre. Not all of them, but some of them.
Yeah, and having the main bunch of the population be asleep on their way there. I was like, hey, mm-hmm. Wow, passengers ripped this off. Of course it didn't, but I thought
yes,
that
as far as I know, I don't think passengers got a copy of the book.
I just thought it was funny that both of those scenarios came out around the same time. So either Orbit had really awesome timing putting your book out or mm-hmm. somebody at Passengers was like, you know, eavesdropping on your brain while you slept.
I think it's just one of those things where you don't know why it happens. It's that whole pop culture mm-hmm. gravitates toward one thing and you, one person, don't realize that you're part of a larger whole. But if you think about it too much, you might start to go mad because the TV show Dark Matter came out after I'd sold this book.
And right.
Dark Matter starts out with 6 people waking up on a starship and not knowing anything about who they are. Now, granted, they have complete amnesia, and there's not murdered them all over the station. So, you know, there are some differences, but when I found out it's like the show based on 6 people wake up and don't know where they are, who they are, I'm just like, no, it's too close. People are going to think I ripped it off.
But you really didn't have that problem, did you? Or did you have your moment of panic and then go, okay, wait, it's all good?
Yeah, I had my moment of panic and then went on. I mean, I just always try to go back to the fact that there's a very dominant plot line about a young girl with something special about her who catches the attention of a vampire and falls in love with him and then becomes incredibly powerful. And am I talking about Buffy? Am I talking about Twilight? Am I talking about Robin McKinley's Sunshine? You know, you don't know, but that one plot line is used a whole lot to great effect. So I wasn't too worried about it.
Okay, cool. So without giving away any or too many teasers, what for you was the most satisfying part of writing this story?
I'm thinking. I try not to give you dead air. I'm actually trying to think. I think that Hero Story was the most fun to write. And Hero has a very unfortunate past, I'll say. And he is the comic relief, but he readily admits that he's the comic relief in order to keep from just starting to scream. You know, I either have to make jokes or I could just sit here and scream about our situation. So which would you prefer? So building up his story and trying to bring him to some sort of satisfying conclusion was probably my favorite bit. And I don't think I gave anything away there.
No. Having someone in that situation be, if I don't laugh, I will cry and not be able to stop crying. You tell me which one you'd rather have me do.
Yeah. Yeah. He's got some issues. So, yeah, I liked writing him probably the best.
Now, I hate this because I had these questions and that you can't answer them without sliding into, you know, dropping tidbits. But the revelation for the reason why all these people were together on the ship, I thought was I could imagine Machiavelli standing up and giving you the slow clap. That's how I thought about it. I just went, holy F, what the damn, girl? That's exactly what I had when I read that part.
It was a lot of work. I mean, it was one of those things, as I said, I'm a pantser. It was one of those things where I think my subconscious knew what I was doing, and it took a couple of drafts to actually tie everything together satisfactorily. But it was, once I realized where the story needed to go, I was very pleased with myself. I'll just say it. I was happy with being able to tie everything up in that way. So thank you. I'm glad you and Machiavelli approved. It took several drafts to get there, but I'm happy with where it landed.
Now, how much rewriting and changing of the story did you have to do once you started working with your editor?
I never know how to answer that question because, you know, once you start putting stuff in and taking stuff out, how do you measure it? Percentages, by hours? I don't know.
Were there any major story shifts that you had to do or just minor little tweaks?
There were. I don't know what I can tell you because whatever I tell you I changed, you'll know it does not happen. How about, I'll just say this, you know, there's a rule, there's a law passed that you cannot put one person's personality into another person's body because of, that's a whole bit of problem, but it's also because they haven't figured out a way to make that so the person won't go insane. And there's a reason I wrote that law, and it had to do with an earlier draft. And that part got cut and changed.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The way the story was layered and how each little thing you learned about the crew and the mission and what they remember and what they don't remember and what they're lying to each other about, the way that's just interwoven like tiramisu is delicious, like tiramisu. But I literally just lost my train of thought because I'm just thinking about the story and my head went boom again.
Oh, I've been there. Don't worry about it.
The way the layering is set up, it pulls you deeper and deeper and deeper. It is one of those stories where you don't want to put it down because when you get back to it, you're like, okay, what do I have to remember again? Where was I? There's just too much to keep in your head to risk wanting to be, you know, interrupted. Let's put it that way. And the fact that it was 99% pantsed.
Yes, it was 99% pantsed, but remember there was a lot of editing. So
true. But still the concept, the characters, the background for the premise just all fit together so nicely.
Thank you.
And I will admit, when I first understood how the clones regenerated, I'm like, don't tell me these are Cylons. But then I started reading the laws and stuff. I'm like, okay, we're good.
No, I not Cylons. Although I didn't even think about Battlestar, but I suppose it's one of those things like the story's just get ingrained into your head and you don't always think. Well, I didn't even think about Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy when I was writing my previous thing, which is essentially Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy for Monsters. And it wasn't until like long after I'd written it, I went, oh, good Lord.
Yeah, you know, I'm such a huge, you know, Battlestar fan. Anytime I see a story where people are waking up in vats, I go, Cylons?
Yeah.
Oh, but no, I just want to reiterate for everybody, Six Wakes is out now. Go read it. You will not be disappointed. Is there an audiobook of this? Did you read that?
Yeah, I narrated the audiobook, and actually, I just heard from my editor today. It should be out shortly. It's not out yet.
So the audiobook's not out yet, but I would actually be interested in hearing that because hearing how you would voice the different characters, I think would be a lot of fun.
I didn't go for accents. Sorry, just lost all my thoughts. I didn't go for accents, but I tried to give everybody a distinct cadence to their voice. I just when you're it's very difficult to do accents without sounding like you're making fun of another ethnicity, and I know people do it all the time. I'm just not confident in my ability to do it. So I just went for a straight read, which is what I usually do.
I totally get it. Totally get it. What else are you working on? What's your next endeavor?
I just turned in the manuscript for I Should Be Writing the Book, which is a nonfiction book based on my podcast that should come out this fall. Or late summer. And after that, I'm in proposal land again. I had a one book deal with Orbit, so I don't have another book sold, so I get to go back to figuring out what I'm going to write next.
What is the I Should Be Writing book? Is that more a collection of the podcasts that you've done, or is that expanding on lessons and stories from the podcast?
I think I'd like to say I expanded on it, but I did have, what, 11 years of stuff to pull from. So I think if you're a listener of my podcast, you will not be surprised by anything in the book, but it's also going to have writing prompts and blank pages, so it's also like a journal. But yeah, I'm just taking a lot of what I talk about in the podcast from the cold truth of even if you're lucky enough to get a $100,000 advance on a trilogy, you don't quit your day job, and here's the math why. To you're allowed to write crap, and here's why, and stuff like that. I did develop the voice of the editor that you're supposed to put away. I did develop two characters that chime in throughout the book called the bully and the muse. And the bully's the one that tells you have to worry about working on a sentence for days just to make sure you get all the right words. That kind of person. So, yeah, it'll be a little bit different, but I not tons.
So, do you think that someday there will ever be a Ditch Diggers book?
I would love there to be a Ditch Diggers book. I hope if I should be writing sells well, I can. Matt's up for it, so I'm hoping we could do a second one for Ditch Diggers down the line. But I think we'd have to see how I Should Be Writing does.
Cool. Well, I wish you luck with I Should Be Writing, and I may have to check out the audiobook for 6 weeks just to satisfy my curiosity.
I hope I don't disappoint. It was fun to do. A lot of work, but audiobooks always are.
Well, where are the best places for people to reach you?
Still at my website, merverse.com. That's where you can find my self-published books and my Orbit published books and my podcast and information about me and all that stuff.
Excellent. Now, there was one other thing. You were finally able to announce after 12 years that Netflix optioned The Shambling Guides. At least it seems
2 years, but it felt like 12.
like. But
Yeah, after 2 years, I was able to announce that Netflix bought the rights to Shambling Guide. Yes, it was about, I guess now it's closer to 3 years since that option was signed. I have no idea. I have no information at all
Nothing.
They bought the option. They wouldn't let me announce it. I sat on the information for 2 years. And then they re-upped the option, which is great. And then they finally announced it. And all I know is that there's a producer attached to it. But I know nothing else beyond that.
So this is really,
Unfortunately.
it hasn't even gotten to development hell yet. It's just at de development. We're staring into the door of purgatory, thinking about going in. I can't believe there's absolutely no information yet, but I trust that if you do learn something you can share, you will.
Oh, of course. Definitely. Well, the funny thing was that they didn't even tell me I could announce it. I took a nap that afternoon. I woke up, I looked at Twitter, and suddenly it was full of congratulations, Murr! And I'm like, I have no idea what's going on. And then I found out some Hollywood magazine had gotten the news of a new acquisition by Netflix, and they were acting like, oh, Netflix is buying all these things now. I'm like, no, it happened 2 years ago. But so they finally announced it, and so I'm still kind of in the dark and trying not to worry too much about it.
Well, as a fan of some of the stuff Netflix has done, I love Travelers. I love the Marvel shows. I think the Shambling Guides are in good hands.
Yeah, I hope so. Just I try not to think about it. You know, it's like it's I was talking to Ty Frank, one half of James S.A. Corey, a couple of weekends ago, and he's like, you know, Hollywood's like a lottery where when you win another lottery ticket. It's like, okay, you got the option. Congratulations. Here's another lottery ticket. And if you win that lottery, then it goes forward in production. Here's another lottery ticket. The different levels of production, which I don't even know what they are because I don't know, but so that's I'm trying to be satisfied with the lottery ticket I have, and you know, write new stuff.
Excellent. Well, good luck with the Shambling Guides. Good luck with Six Wakes and the I Should Be Writing book.
Thank you.
Like I said, I've already reviewed it. I posted my review there. People, go check this book out. You will not be disappointed. If you are, meet me outside. We'll talk.
Summer's got my back.
Oh
Awesome.
yeah, oh hell yeah. This one made me happy. It gave me great moments of entertainment, great moments of, oh, cool. And you know what? This makes me feel good. People I know doing good stuff and hopefully doing very well by them.
Cool. Thank you.
You're very welcome. I am actually happy that I get to use this interview because I first recorded it a year ago, thinking that I would get Writers After Dark started last year, but I had some major life issues intrude and a whole lot of things got put on hold. But now that Six Wakes has been nominated for the Hugo Award, the Nebula Award, and the Philip K. Dick Award, and Murr herself has been nominated for Hugo's in three different categories, including Best Semi-Pro Zine and Best Fan Cast. I figured this would be a appropriate time to actually be able to use this interview, which I'm so happy for because I know how hard she works on her writing. I've been listening to I Should Be Writing since the beginning. Known Murr since the old Dragon Page days, and I'm glad to finally see her works being appreciated because she deserves it. Maybe Matt too. We'll talk. Just kidding, Matt. Anyway, if you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me. The place to send that is summer@writersafterdark.com, or you can call in, leave a voicemail message. The number is 602-635-6976. Yes, that is the Slice of Sci-Fi voicemail number. We share the number because we can. You can listen to Writers After Dark through iTunes, through Stitcher, and through Google Play. Yes, we have all of our links in place, so you can find those links in the show notes. You can also leave a review for the show on all three locations, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can check us out on Twitter. The ID is Write After Dark. And you can also come to the website, writersafterdark.com. Leave a comment on the podcast or weigh in with your own assessment of the reviews that are being done for the books here. I'd like to thank everybody who's supporting these efforts, both here at Writers After Dark and Slice of Sci-Fi. The folks pledging through Patreon, you are really lifesavers, and I want to thank you all. If you want to check out how to join in, the place to go is patreon.com/sliceofscifi. Or you can do a one-time donation through the paypal.me link, which you can also find in the show notes. I'd also like to throw a shout out to Sybin Quest and Shade On for the theme music here. You can follow links to their websites and find more music by them, especially Shay, who helped me orchestrate getting the music for this show. That'll do it for this episode. See you next time. And remember, keep looking for your own stories.